The Tom Woods Show, episode 534.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
If you're like me, sometimes you feel like you don't have time for anything. So if you'd like to learn another language, you think, how could I fit that in? But you can learn it on your commute with Rocket Languages. Check out a free mini course at tomwoods.com/rocket. Welcome to the Tom Woods Show. It's no secret that one of my favorite people in the world is our guest today, Brad Berzer. And Brad has a brand new book that it's going to be a lot of fun to talk about. I'm going to tell you about it in just a minute. I just want to remind you who Brad Berzer is. He's a professor of history at Hillsdale College. He's the author of several books. We've talked about at least one of them in the past. And he's also a progressive rock lover like me, so we talk about obscure music that's awesome from time to time. He is the co-founder of theimaginativeconservative.org and just an all-around great guy, a gentleman, a scholar. I don't know what more to say about him. When I had him for one of the live sessions at Liberty Classroom, everybody just loved him. He was just fantastic. They loved the course that he produced for us. He's producing more courses for libertyclassroom.com. But today we're going to talk about his book, brand new, just out, Russell Kirk, American Conservative. Russell Kirk has as good a claim as anybody to be the architect of modern American conservatism, if you can say there's one person, and if you can call him the architect. But certainly he's somebody who helped to define what conservatives believe or are supposed to believe. So when you talk about Russell Kirk, so many things are talked about at the same time. Like it brings up so many related issues, the very subject of Russell Kirk. Libertarianism, because Kirk had an interesting relationship with libertarians, and conservatives have had an interesting relationship with libertarians. We're going to talk a bit about that relationship, but also Kirk was not a friend of the neoconservatives. This is very important. Here's Kirk, this iconic figure in the history of conservatism, and he is not a friend of the neocons. Very important, and it's fun to throw that in their faces. Well, wait a minute, you phony balonies. How come Russell Kirk didn't like you? I mean, presumably he would know a little something about conservatism, wouldn't he? So there's a lot of fun stuff here to talk about. Of course, I will link to Brad's book at tomwoods.com/534, the show notes page for today. Brad, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Tom. Always great to talk to you.
I've just told everybody about your new book, and it's thrilling because this really is such a contribution. I was looking at the footnotes, and it's so obvious how much time you spent in the Kirk papers. The footnotes are, there's so many of them that are primary sources, which of course is what a biography should be. But there's nobody who's done this to the extent that you have in terms of a study of Kirk. It's really amazing. And as I was reading through the book, I was struck at how lazy a person I am by comparison to Kirk, because he rebukes himself for being lazy at one point, and then he talks about how he's got to catch up on his correspondence, and this is long before the age of email. This is like the mid-70s, and you note that in August, he took 3 solid days and caught up on 180 letters that he had to mail by hand and everything else, and then he could get back to his work. And I thought, here I've got email. I'm one click away from answering people, and I still can't do it. So you must have had to go through a mountain of correspondence.
Yeah, you know, Tom, and it, of course, thanks to Annette Kirk for giving me the trust and allowing me to do that. It's amazing how much there is. That correspondence, which I couldn't calculate. If you asked me to give you a rough estimate of how many letters are archived up at Macosta, I'm not even sure I could get that close. I assume there are tens of thousands of papers and letters. And I do think about, my gosh, can you imagine what the expense is, having to pay stamps and envelopes and paper for 180 letters just in 3 days? And that, back then, that was a huge expense. But yeah, those letters are brilliant. Everybody from Flannery O'Connor to T.S. Eliot to Barry Goldwater to Ronald Reagan, you know, just anyone you can imagine who really mattered at the time for roughly a 50-year period, their letters are all right there, and Kirk kept them in pristine shape. So that archive is a real treasure trove for anyone who would want to study libertarianism, conservatism, anything dealing with politics during any of those decades. It really is a stunning thing.
I wonder if public intellectuals like Kirk felt it to be kind of an obligation that came with what he did for a living to keep up with his correspondence. Because when I wrote to Murray Rothbard back in the early 1990s, just on a lark, I wrote to him. He wrote back to me. He wrote me a letter back. And whereas today, I mean, I do try to answer email, but I have so many family obligations and so much going on in my life. Sometimes I have to make make choices, and sometimes the email suffers, and yet Rothbard answers a nobody like me.
Maybe he knew that you would not be a nobody.
Maybe so. Who knows?
He had his finger on the pulse of the future.
Well, I was really, really starstruck to get that in the mail. Now, it's I mention him not coincidentally here because, of course, he and Kirk had a bit of a relationship, perhaps a rocky one. So we'll talk about libertarianism a little bit later. If you want to know about basically 20th century thought in America and you're interested in libertarianism and or conservatism, it's impossible not to study Kirk and not to know a bit about Kirk. So you give us a little bit of the background of his life in terms of what he did. We know he wrote The Conservative Mind, but he did a lot more than that. And then I want to get into what his contributions were.
Oh, that's great, Tom. Yeah. So Kirk was born in 1918, born in absolute poverty. His family, his father, no matter how hard of a worker he was, just never could make ends meet. So he comes from a long line on his mother's side of kind of skilled blue-collar intellectuals, very impressive men. And one of the things I argue in the book that I found very interesting was that when Kirk talks about love of father and piety, he really is talking about his mother and his mother's father. He is definitely not talking about his own dad, for whom he had love, but not much respect. But Kirk, coming out of that very poor environment, I think was always determined to make something of his life, but not in the sense that he wanted to get rich. He wanted to do good, but he was never that concerned with money. In fact, he's one of the most terrible managers of money I've ever encountered in my life. He made so much eventually and basically had nothing when he died. But what he did after he went to college, and he went to graduate school at Duke and got his MA in history there, he was then drafted into the military, spent 1942 to 1946 in Utah at a chemical weapons facility. Once he left there, he went on to graduate school starting in 1948 at the University of St. Andrews, earned his D.Litt, which is a little bit higher than a Ph.D., earned his D.Litt in 1952, and then amazingly published his dissertation to huge acclaim. His dissertation, The Conservative Mind, or what would be called The Conservative Mind, really did give voice to almost every non-leftist person in America and actually in the English-speaking world in the late 1940s and early 1950s. So for kind of a brief moment in the summer of 1953, Kirk was the voice of all conservatism and libertarianism, really kind of channeling Albert J. Nock and Isabel Patterson, a couple of other conservatives who've been forgotten. But he was able to bring all of those people together and give them voice in that book, which ultimately, over its 7 editions, sold well over 1 million copies. So between roughly 1953 and 1986, sold about 1 million copies. After that, and maybe we could get into some of the details on this, Tom, but after that, he tried his hand at fiction. He did extremely well. In fact, his first novel, Old House of Fear, sold more than all of his other books combined. That book sold for about 17 years and is really credited with reimagining horror in the 20th century as a genre. And there really would be no Stephen King without Russell Kirk.
No, hold on a minute. Are you really saying that?
I'm really saying that. Kirk's book, Old House of Fear, in 1960, really did open up horror as a genre. Prior to that, it had been, there had been some literary attempts, like the whole story of Bram Stoker's Dracula. But for it to become a mass movement beyond just pulp fiction, it took Kirk's book. And it does open it up, not just to Stephen King, but to Clive Barker, to really anyone who wrote horror in the 1970s. They owe a lot to Kirk for that. So, yes, that book was a major book. And how strange. I mean, Tom, you know, when I usually talk to people in conservatism and libertarian and the libertarian movements, they don't have a clue Kirk wrote this stuff. And most people in the horror world who know Kirk had no idea he was the guy who wrote The Conservative Mind. So, yeah, that's he made most of his money off of his fiction. Really.
Okay. See, I have a collection of his ghost stories, I think, but I don't think I ever read them.
They're worth reading. They are challenging. I would put him, you know, if I were to rate him, and I'm no literary scholar, but I love literature. Yeah, I would put him at about, his writing style is about the level of Ray Bradbury at his B-plus writing. He's not at the level of Ray Bradbury at his best, but I do think he's as good as Stephen King. But I don't think he's as good as, say, Flannery O'Connor. So his short stories are very good. They're not brilliant, but they have great moral lessons in them, and they're pretty dark. As dark, and I read a lot of Stephen King. They're as dark as anything King wrote.
Early on in the book, you say that a lot of times libertarianism gets, we talk a lot about, you know, no, actually not libertarianism. I let me correct myself here. You're saying that when we think about conservatives, a lot of times these days we think in terms of what their views in politics and economics are. And you note that for Kirk, although he obviously did write on those topics, he wrote on them without much energy or enthusiasm or originality. He didn't have a whole lot that was original to contribute to these things. And that if you're going to look through the prism of politics and economics, you're not really going to get who Kirk was. Now, that's an interesting thing, and I'd like to hear then what it is that Kirk did think was important that a conservative should be talking about and should conserving. But as I just think through the titles of Kirk that just come to mind, he writes a program for conservatives. That's political. He has a book on free market economics. He wrote a bio of John Randolph of Roanoke, who was a political figure. So how can you make that stick? I'd like to be persuaded of this because it sounds right to me.
I think it's – maybe I can put it this way, Tom. You're absolutely right, and the intent of your question is absolutely right. He really saw politics as important, but he saw other things as more important or equally important. So he would never – and we have to put ourselves in the time. Imagine, for example, his great hero, Albert J. Nock. Albert J. Nock is remembered for many things, but we rarely read him for his politics. We may read him, for example, in Our Enemy, the State, as having this, yeah, just absolute, he just despised the New Deal. But in large part, he despised the New Deal because of its political character. And much of what someone like Albert J. Nock wrote about was education, or he wrote about the classics, or, you know, even weird things for us, at least today, about how to dress or how to speak. And that's the kind of tradition Kirk was coming out of. He would not have thought of politics as the end all be all. Now, he does in many ways betray his own views on this, because in the late 1950s, he becomes so enamored with Barry Goldwater, and the feeling is mutual, that he becomes very involved in actual practical politics from about 1957 up until 1964, and then again briefly during the Reagan administration. But that is really an aberration. It's an extremely important one, but it is an aberration for Kirk's life. He had argued as early as 1953 with The Conservative Mind that the true conservative would dedicate his life to scholarship or poetry or art, and really only, as he put it, and he's so nasty about this, that really only the quarter educated would devote their time to politics. But he did find in Goldwater an exemplar and someone that he really thought had the charisma, the intellect, and the ability to present a message that was necessary to bring down politics within the political sphere rather than actually advocate it. So, you know, and Kirk, I don't know how much of this I want to stress because as a biographer, I tried to balance this out. But there is no doubt that as a young man, a very young man, a man in his 20s, Kirk would have been very comfortable calling himself an anarchist. He would not have felt that way by the late 1950s. But certainly as a young man, his views on the draft, on World War II, on the New Deal, these were things to be despised, and despised for very, very moral and ethical reasons, not just political reasons.
Let's talk about the conservative mind for a bit. We talked about that the last time we talked about Kirk on this show, but that was so many episodes ago, I don't even remember what number it was. What was the point? Let me just ask you this basic question. What was the point of the conservative mind? And I don't just mean what is its thesis, although we should talk about that, but what does he want to accomplish with it? I mean, I think my sense is he must realize that he may in fact be writing a book for the ages in writing that. Why then? What is it? What's necessary for him to accomplish in this book?
Yeah, you know, Tom, I would say that there's really very few things in Kirk's life that he didn't do with at least keeping in mind writing for the ages or thinking for the ages. I mean, this, in a lot of ways, you just grabbed Kirk in a nutshell because that's what he always wanted. He believed life being very short was this thing that we had to do excellent at. That is, everything we do, we must pursue excellence in everything, whether you know, it's in friendship or cooking or writing a book. In that sense, he is a very, very stoic character, and he did believe in that. In a lot of ways, just like his great friend Ed Opitz, in ways like Henry Hazlitt did, in ways like Albert J. Nock. I mean, this old school of libertarian conservative, of course, believed that you don't do anything without committing yourself fully. And that's something I find very attractive. You know, we find that, I think, in people like Steve Jobs. But of course, Steve Jobs went off in a radically different direction and certainly wouldn't have held the same kind of views of life that these guys did. But the conservative mind, as his dissertation that he wrote for J.W. Williams at the University of St. Andrews, yeah, I'm not sure he actually thought it would be the seller it was. He certainly hoped that he would make.
No, there's no way you could have predicted that a book like this would sell that way.
No,
impossible.
That's right. And it is, you know, it's funny. I don't know if you knew this, Tom. You can actually go back now. The University of St. Andrews has made his entire dissertation available online as a PDF. So you can go back. And he has very funny things in it. I mean, one thing people don't realize about Kirk, because he could be so quiet and soft-spoken, is he was absolutely hilarious. And he throws a lot of jokes into his books. And there really is a kind of just mischievous humor in a lot of what he writes. But that the conservative mind was meant to give voice to everybody who is not an ideological leftist at the end of World War II. It's caught up in the questions of America at the beginning of the Cold War. Who are we? What are we fighting for? What do we believe in? So he was trying to give voice, and he did believe, and I think we could argue with him on this, but he firmly believed that there was a coherent anti-ideological voice, whatever we want to call it, kind of classical liberalism or conservatism. He believed that there was a coherent voice that could be found from Edmund Burke all the way up to T.S. Eliot. And that's what he was trying to do. He was trying to create, in many ways, a very postmodern thing. He was trying to create a narrative that established a number of different characters. In fact, in the conservative mind, there are three major characters: Edmund Burke, John Adams, and T.S. Eliot. And then there are 26 supporting characters, ones that we wouldn't necessarily put together. People like Nathaniel Hawthorne and then Irving Babbitt. We wouldn't necessarily say, oh, of course, we would jump from one to the other. But that's what Kirk saw, and that's what he was trying to do, to give that voice to everybody who was not a leftist.
I guess we need at some point to talk about what he views a conservative as, because certainly it is different from a libertarian, and he sees it as being different, and there are commitments that a conservative has that a libertarian might not. Now, I know he's got something like 9 things that go into this, so maybe you can encapsulate these somehow.
Sure. It's hard to say in the beginning. There are 7 editions of the conservative mind, and there's no doubt that they go from edition 1, which is very, very sympathetic to anarchism and libertarianism, especially as understood by Albert J. Nock and Isabel Patterson, to the final version, which reads much more, and that's 1986, it reads much more like a traditionalist kind of creed. And so Kirk, who's very big tent in the beginning, I think becomes much less so. My own view on this is that Kirk does so for personal reasons. He gets into fights with Frank Chodorov. He gets into arguments with Frank Meyer. He and Hayek always maintain a decent relationship with one another. And you actually find more praise of Hayek in volume seven or in version seven than you do in number one. But I think it's easier to look at it this way, Tom, rather than thinking of it as libertarian or conservative or some mixing of both. I think Kirk very strongly believed that, as he puts it in the conservative mind, that there are six ways of thinking about conservatism. And he puts these in a way that we could interpret them in a variety of different fashions. And this is where I think for a lot of people like Hayek and Hazlitt, they get frustrated, understandably, with Kirk. Kirk intentionally uses the language that these are canons, right? C-A-N-O-N-S. And he's taking that, even though he's at best a kind of lukewarm theist at that point, but really still an agnostic. He won't become a Roman Catholic and a Christian until 1964. So when he's writing in 1953, he's still 11 years away from that. But he takes the language of the Catholic Church, and as you and I as Catholics, Tom, both know, but Kirk was not as conversant in, a canon is an argument. It's not a decree. It's not an absolute. A canon is an argument. And so if we had a Dominican, a Jesuit, and a Franciscan arguing, they could each be arguing from canons. That is, they each make a statement. The Franciscan might think about free will. The Dominican might think about free will. The Jesuit might think about free will. But they wouldn't be saying it in the same way. And so Kirk uses the language of canon rather than decree, because in his mind, the creation of conservative thought must be based on principle that is universal, but it must also be particular in its understanding. So the Irish may have one way of thinking about it, Northern Germans another, people in Botswana another, and Kirk is totally fine with that. So there are certain things. Murder is wrong everywhere, in every culture, in every time, in every place. It doesn't matter if we're in Athens or Rome or Washington, D.C., murder is just wrong. But the shaking of someone's hand is cultural. And so in some places we might bow, in others we might do some other kind of gesture. In America, as small R Republicans, we shake hands. And so Kirk was actually that adamant that there are certain things we know for certain. There are other things that are culturally specific. And I think he's frustrating for a lot of people because he's not willing to challenge a lot of those culturally specific things. He will go to his death defending murder being wrong. But you know, when it comes to attire or how we present ourselves, those are things that he's not willing to state. And that's why he never, even in Program for Conservatives, he never gets into what our tax policy should be or education policy should be, because frankly, he's just too much of a humanist there. And it drives the economists and the social scientists just crazy, and understandably. But he looks at things much more poetically and never mathematically. Even, as you know, Tom, even in his book on free market economics, it's really all about virtue. You know, of course, law of supply and demand matters. But what matters more is that you do things excellently. Right? That's just, you know, does that mean you're going to make more profit? Probably. But that's not what Kirk's concerned about. You know, he's concerned that if you build this thing, you do it with every ounce of excellence. Everything that you have, you pour into it.
Well, that makes me want to ask, he is opposed to, I hate the expression big government. It just is so third grade to me.
No, it's okay. He says Leviathan, right?
Okay, Leviathan. So, okay, yeah, that's much better. So he's opposed to Leviathan, obviously, but for different reasons. And so I want to get into why a real conservative, not somebody who writes for National Review today necessarily, although I don't want to put down National Review because they darn well better review your book on Kirk, or the conservative movement is just doomed completely if they won't even review a biography of Kirk.
National Review has been very good to me and was very good to Kirk. So
okay, all right. So we're not going to, but I think you know what I mean.
Yes.
There has been a kind of juvenile evolution of the conservative movement. But I mean, a real conservative in the Kirk mold. What are the dangers that he sees in Leviathan, and how are they unique as compared to what we might hear in a Republican presidential debate or a libertarian magazine?
This is where, Tom, I think we do, and I don't want to contextualize him or historicize him, but this is where he is very clearly a man of the 40s and 50s. This is where he loves the individual, and he hates individualism. He believes very strongly that, and this is one of his, I think it's principle number two or canon number two, but I don't have my copy of The Conservative Mind in front of me, Tom, which was stupid. I should have done that for this interview. But he says, and this is, these are his words, though he's playing on John Randolph of Roanoke. He argues that every single person is a principle of proliferating variety. This is the way Kirk likes to put it. Of course, he loves arcane language. But what he means by this is that, and of course, at this point, when he's writing in 1953, he basically means nature. Later, he'll mean God. But this is where everybody, you, Tom, your wife, me, my wife, all of my kids, all of your kids, every single person listening to this podcast, every person who ever has existed or ever will exist, is made in a certain time, in a certain place, endowed with very specific gifts, excellences. And of course, they're excellent because no one ever will be able to do exactly what that person does. So the greatest violinist in the world, we love that violinist because of the excellence they bring to that instrument. We love the great woodworker because of the excellence of the piece of furniture or whatever it may be. But we also carry with us for Kirk, and whether we're thinking in old classical terms or modern Judeo-Christian terms, we also carry with us sins and flaws. Those sins and flaws are the lowest common denominator because, Tom, no matter how great you are at certain things, and you are obviously very great at certain things, you and I both share in the same nastiness. We both, at whatever level, at some level, have jealousy, we have avarice, we have lust, and those are the kinds of things we have in common. So what we have in common are our worst qualities. What we don't have in common are our excellences. You will be able to do things I will never be able to do. And that means for Kirk, real individuals, real belief in individual, in an individual excellence, must mean inequality. It must mean that we promote the brilliance of a person as opposed to the nastiness of a person. And so for him, and this is where he sounds no different than Albert J. Nock, for him, what is life about? Life is about the individual living to the fullest of her or his potential using the gifts that nature or God gave that person. And nobody, no government, no God has the right to interfere with that. I mean, in that sense, Kirk is a hardcore small R Republican. I mean, he truly believes that life is living out those excellences. You know, so imagine Kirk, who is one of the weirdest people who's ever lived in this world. You know, Kirk, who never went anywhere without a three-piece suit, even when he hiked in the summer of 1963 with Thomas Molnar across North Africa, Kirk wore his three-piece suit because that's what he did and that's what men do. And he carried with him a sword stick, this huge staff where he could pull a sword out. Yeah, I mean, he was a bizarre person in almost every way. But that, you know, for him, he was doing what he wanted to do. And, you know, to say, my gosh, he's an anti-individualist. Well, he didn't like individualism because he thought individualism, as understood in the 50s and the 60s, was really just conformity to some goal, like the hippies. Yeah, they're all individualists, and yet they all look alike, they all smell alike, they all live alike. He truly believed in real individualism as opposed to that kind of ideological individualism. So what was Leviathan? Well, for him, Leviathan was that thing which always tried to crush us. It always tried to make us less than what nature or God meant us to be. It did so through regulations, through taxes, through public schools, through bureaucracies. Government existed if it existed beyond creating order, or not, he would not say create order, maintaining order in the old Augustinian sense. Well, what was it? Well, it only existed to crush our individuality. So that's why he hated Leviathan so much. It can't create, and it really does nothing more than protect against those who would try and smash us. And yet, you know, as we know, Tom, and as you and Lou Rockwell have talked about, Kirk saw at the end of his life that not only was our government becoming Leviathan at home, but it would very soon spread Leviathan abroad. And this would just further the collapse, not only of world order, but of order at home as well. Sorry, that's a lot longer than you wanted, Tom. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. And the thing is, I have several other things I definitely want to make sure I ask you. And of course,
that one I'm really passionate about. So.
Well, no, that's fine. That's fine. No, we talked about libertarianism quite a bit last time, so I don't want to repeat too much of that. It's unavoidable, though, given this is a libertarian show.
Sure.
I do want to get to it. I want to say one quick thing about – I think I read at least a portion of – I think it was called The Sword of Imagination, which was his own memoir.
Yes, his biography, his autobiography.
Yeah, autobiography, yeah. And as I recall, he referred to himself in the third person throughout. He referred to – I guess his home had burned down, and that was referred to as the Great Fire, capital G, capital F. There was – I mean – I don't think I can avoid the word pomposity there. Do you want to say anything about that?
But he's quirky. There's no doubt about that. He was actually a very humble person. And it's unfortunate that the writing style he employed in that book makes him look just the opposite. He was trying to be objective. But I agree, Tom. It's not – didn't come out as well as I think he wanted to. I will throw this in. And a lot of people talk about his archaic writing style. There are two people who are living at Macosta right now that you probably know, Marcia and Alex, who are Portuguese, and they are very high up in the Mises Institute, not only here, but in Brazil as well. One of the things they've had to do, and I found this fascinating, because obviously you and I are native English speakers, I don't think about this, but as they've translated Kirk into Portuguese, they have found that they have to go back to 18th century dictionaries to understand what he's doing. And I found that fascinating and very revealing about Kirk.
That is indeed. And I find that sometimes there are just ways of sometimes he writes in a way that would be elegant for the present day, but other times, even it's just the word order.
Oh, it's so archaic.
Yeah, it's and I think sometimes to me it just rubbed me the wrong way because it seemed like he's trying too hard.
Yeah.
He's and he doesn't have to because he's very smart and he has a lot of interesting things to say. He doesn't have to, so it comes off as an affectation whether he means it or not.
Yeah, he definitely doesn't mean it, but I agree. It does come across that way and it does turn a lot of people off.
All right. Here are the things I want to get to. The last thing I want to get to would be libertarianism. I found it fascinating that when Hayek gave that speech about why I am not a libertarian, that I did not realize until I had you on that Kirk was in the audience for that, that it was almost certainly meant as a reply to Kirk, and that Kirk delivered an extemporaneous reply of which we have no record. I mean, what the heck? I mean, that is a case where I don't care what Kirk's views of technology might have been, YouTube would have made our lives a lot happier because I want to know what he had to say to Hayek. But let's start here. When you say that Kirk writes in the tradition of Christian humanism, what does that mean? Without any jargon, what is Christian humanism? I found it interesting, by the way, that Kirk was such a partisan of Pico della Mirandola, which kind of surprised me.
Yeah, I think that surprises a lot of people. It does me as well. It doesn't make a lot of sense. In the same way that he absolutely loves Marcus Aurelius, and when he was pushed, and people would say, well, you realize, you know, Aurelius just persecuted Christians to end, Kirk's response was, okay. So, you know, some weird aspects there. Christian humanism is really the tradition of Thomas More and Erasmus. And it was simply, it's not as convoluted as it sounds. It's basically the argument that because Christians, as they went into the world, had to, as a religion with the Great Commission, to go out and by two, convert all peoples, right, or at least potentially, that as they went into the world, they would always be encountering people who were not themselves, whether it was, you know, the Druids or the Norse or Asian Indians. And therefore, they actually had a duty as humanists to actually learn about those cultures. So you find it in the 20th century, it was a major movement. And it's people like Jacques Maritain, Etienne Gilson, Romano Guardini, John Paul II talked in terms all the time of Christian humanism. And so there were a lot of people who were involved in this. And it was their way, Kirk as well, is basically saying, you know, conservatism is not right-wing. It's also not left-wing. It transcends both. It's something because it's not political. It really is man versus anti-man, or God versus anti-God. And it's so they would think of it as a cross. You have the left-right spectrum, but you also have up-down. So that's when Kirk wrote about Christian humanism, and he really is kind of the great American Christian humanist. He was basically saying we shouldn't see a conflict between the pagan world and the Christian world, or between the liberal arts and scripture, that they, in fact, coalesce very nicely one with another. So I hope that answers you, Tom, without using jargon at all. But it's really more of a movement of peoples, Thomas Merton, Flannery O'Connor, Willa Cather, than it is an actual ideology. In fact, it's very definitely not an ideology. And you can see that by looking at the kinds of writings that you find.
All right. I want to, as I say, I'm just about to get to what my listeners will think of as the really juicy part. But before we do that, let's just pause for this message. So you'd like to learn a foreign language, but you feel you just don't have the time. Well, Rocket Languages is the solution. Their interactive audio lessons are designed to be listened to while on your commute. But it's not just that. They also have language and culture lessons. And you'll learn thousands of common words and phrases that you won't learn in a typical textbook, but that will help you navigate your new language. Plus reinforcement testing to help you remember what you've learned, voice recognition to improve your pronunciation and accent, and unlimited 24/7 lifetime online access to the Rocket Languages team of language teachers, native speakers, and fellow language enthusiasts. Get a free mini course through tomwoods.com/rocket. A ton of Tom Woods Show listeners have written to tell me they love it. tomwoods.com/rocket. All right, there is one other thing I want to get to before we do the libertarian stuff. I want to know the sense in which the word boredom is used. When you say that Kirk wrote about boredom, we're not talking about, well, you know, my video game machine doesn't work, so I'm sitting around all day kind of bored. When he's talking about boredom in the modern world, what does he mean, and what's the cause of it, and what can be done about it?
Well, there are couple of things. What Kirk really means by that is de Tocqueville's idea of associations. That is, that we really should be involved in community. Whether that community is, you know, Little League baseball, or whether that community is writing a book and addressing a certain audience or a certain topic, he is using this in the old, very old-fashioned sense that leisure, properly understood, is not going to the beach and relaxing, or going to, you know, Six Flags or Coney Island. Leisure is using your time to read and to contemplate and to think. So he was very worried that in the 20th century, and this is a very common Christian humanist fear, he was very worried that people had stopped thinking in terms of, what do I do with my neighbors? How do I help my neighbors? What do I do in community? What's an association? But instead became really isolated one from another and spent their time doing things such as merely watching TV. So it fits a lot. And this is one reason a lot of the communitarians, modern communitarians, think so highly of Kirk. Though I'm not sure he would think that highly of them, mostly because he believes he would have believed that they'd kind of made an ideology out of this. But he does think that in a voluntary kind of way, we should be living out the life that de Tocqueville saw we were best at, doing good, working in neighborhoods, helping people. And Kirk was, you know, however quirky he was, and he was, you know, Kirk spent his vast fortune and he made millions of dollars from his books. This is not someone who was not living on a lot. He was grown up in poverty, but he made so much money on his writings, especially his fiction and on his speeches. But he also believed that, you know, he had to give that all away. And so his letters, you go back to his letters in the 1950s, people like John Lukacs, the very famous historian, you know, Kirk, if they need money, Kirk just sticks bills, lots of bills, into an envelope and sends them off. He and his wife, Annette, once he marries in 1964, you know, they would drive around Grand Rapids and they would pick up homeless people, or they would find people who had, women who had been battered or who were pregnant and were unwedded, and he would take them back. They would take them back to the house. They brought over people like Ivan Pongrasek, who I know you know because he's a great Austrian economist. Ivan Pongrasek was helped. You know, he was brought out of of Yugoslavia with Kirk's help, and then raised in Macosta under Kirk's not only money, but also sponsorship. There were times that there would be tens, maybe upwards of 30 Ethiopians or Cambodians living at the Kirk house, because they opened up their house to anybody who needed help. And so when Kirk died in 1994, and we may say he wasn't financially responsible, and I think we could say that, but he was also so charitable that they were broke because he had spent all his money helping people. And that's the kind of thing, when he talks about boredom, he means that we should spend our lives aiding one another and not watching TV, not just being so absorbed in our own lives that we ignore others. So that's where, you know, he's obviously not an extreme individualist, but he's clearly an extreme individual. And for him, boredom meant that we had turned away from the needs of our neighbors and our communities and had become isolated to self. And one of his great arguments, and I think we could go back and forth on this because it's too simple, and I will freely admit it's too simple, but he firmly believed that one of the reasons, one of the major reasons so many people fell victim to fascism, Nazism, and communism is simply because they had become bored with their lives, and Hitler and Mussolini and Lenin and Stalin had offered concrete truths. They may be truths that are absolute lies, but they were presented as something good, and people gravitated towards those. So Kirk believed very strongly, if we don't love neighbor and we don't love self, we will turn to these abstractions and fall victim over time to evils that are presented as truths.
Let's talk now about libertarianism. You note in here that he had friends who thought of themselves as being either libertarians or sympathetic to the libertarian message, people who were more or less libertarians, but there were people he thought were just too darn extreme, and that was compounded by the fact that he had personal difficulties with some of them, Rothbard maybe chief among them. So what can we say about Kirk and libertarianism, given that the impression one is left with by his writings, which he doesn't have much on libertarianism, but what he does have has been talked about over and over, is that these people are just absolutely opposed to conservatism, that they are ideological fanatics, and therefore they, you know, maybe they're right about some things, but it's totally overshadowed by their errors.
Yeah, Tom, that's a hard one, because you're right. The two writings he has published on libertarianism are so brutal towards libertarianism, and really such a caricature of a certain type of libertarian that I don't think they really apply. But it's what, you know, most people, and especially if I go to IHS or, you know, to other groups, and I mention Kirk, you know, the automatic reaction is, oh, you know, this is a guy who hated libertarians. Larry Reed of Fee, I think, has done a really good job, and he helped me a lot with this. And I quoted him extensively in the chapter on politics in the book, because he recognizes, and I think Larry understood where Kirk was coming from about this, even though Larry himself is, I think no one would question his libertarian street cred is quite strong. And certainly Kirk loved Larry, thought very highly of him. He loved Peter Stanlis, who regarded himself as a libertarian. He didn't have problems at all with people who thought of themselves as libertarians, but he did have problems with people who used that libertarianism as a way to exclude others. And he did, there's no question, Kirk wrote those two very nasty articles on libertarians. What I think is often ignored, though, is Kirk actually wrote, and this doesn't necessarily excuse it, but, you know, for every article he wrote on libertarianism, he wrote five articles against the neoconservatives. And that's often ignored, I think, by libertarians. Part of what Kirk really worried about, and he may be as guilty as anyone of this, though he didn't see it in himself, he really did believe that the movement to succeed, that is, the movement to fight the leftist ideologues, must be unified. It must be brought together. And that sounds strange, because in his writings on neocons and libertarians, he's basically kicking them out of the movement. But the reason he was doing that is because he believed they had already isolated themselves from the movement. And of course, imagine Kirk's closest ally in the political world was Barry Goldwater. And I don't think any national prominent figure in the 20th century came closer to almost a pure libertarianism than Goldwater did. And so, you know, it's hard to say Kirk hated libertarians that he hated libertarianism. I think there were certain libertarians like Frank Meyer, at least Meyer saw himself as one for a while, and Frank Chodorov, that he couldn't stand. But another thing to keep in mind, Tom, and I feel like I'm just being an apologist for Kirk, and I don't mean to do that because there are flaws there, and I think Kirk went overboard on a lot of this. But we have to remember that in the 1950s, Buckley, Chodorov, and Kirk all saw themselves as absolutely without question the legitimate heirs of Albert J. Nock. And so there was something deeply personal there about who gets to claim the mantle of Nock. And all three of them thought that they were the legitimate inheritors of that mantle. We don't remember Nock that well anymore. Even libertarians have kind of forgotten him. But there was no greater figure in the anti-left movement of the 1940s than Nock was. Nock was everything. And when he passed away in 1945, you know, that left a huge vacuum in the movement. And I don't think we would exaggerate to say that so much of the rise of modern libertarianism and conservatism comes out of the attempt to fill that vacuum in the 40s and 50s of Nock's voice that was now missing.
I hadn't realized until you said it just now the proportion of, just how much of his attention he devoted to the neoconservatives as opposed to libertarians. And that, of course, gives me an idea. I've become an idea man, Brad.
You are an entrepreneurial intellectual, Tom.
That's what I'm trying to be, and I just got a good idea. I don't know how many writings he has on the neocons, but if they're substantial, that should be a book.
They are very
put together. Kirk against the neocons.
You could easily put together a nice book on that. Absolutely.
And I mean, just have it be him talking about them so that when somebody like me goes out there and says, look, you people are phony baloney conservatives, I'll be able to hold this book up and say, look, Kirk has greater authority to say this than anybody in this room. So be quiet and listen. What were his complaints?
Well, you know, the amazing thing, Tom, is most of what he said against the neocons was said in his lectures at the Heritage Foundation.
Really? Okay. So is there anything else other than those?
Oh, well, yes. You know, partly what happened, and again, you and Rockwell talked about this in your conversation about Kirk, but Kirk had been a pretty hardcore Reaganite, and you know, he believed Reagan had his problems, but he also thought that Reagan was really capable of bringing together the various schools of conservatism and that he did it extremely well. And he also believed that Reagan's foreign policy overall was quite measured. What he despised was Bush. And Kirk really, you know, when he kind of recognized, there's a moment in 19—I know I'm being recorded here, Tom, but I may be wrong about this. I think it's 87 that Kirk, for the first time, becomes quite worried about neoconservatism and especially about domestically about people like Michael Novak, whom he does not respect at all. And he's worried about what these guys are doing, the spirit of democratic capitalism. He thinks, no, there's just, you know, the free market is good because it's good. We don't need to make an ideology around it. He was worried about that, and especially mixing it with theology, he found quite dangerous. But what worried him even more was the first Gulf War. This, you know, and of course, Kirk is near death at this point. He's 1991. He's only 3 years away from dying. He doesn't know, of course, he's going to die. But his health declines dramatically in the 90s. And when he starts, you know, I think had he lived beyond 94, I think he would have produced a lot about neoconservatism. But he really did dedicate his last 3 years in life writing as much as he could against the neoconservatives. He had been blind to how powerful they were until the invasion of the Gulf War, or the invasion of Iraq. And at that point, he was really kind of panicking. So yes, there's really good stuff he said at at Heritage. He wrote about it. He did a series of pamphlets for a place in Houston that, as far as I know, doesn't exist anymore. It was a little group called Conservatives Do Care. And he was writing at that point everything he could against neoconservatism abroad. And that's when, and you may know this history far better than I do, Tom, that's when in 92, he and Murray Rothbard put all their differences aside and met in a number of different hotels and places where they tried to create a new organization that would influence the Republican Party against imperialism. And we don't have a lot of records for those, but he definitely buried the hatchet with Rothbard, and they became quite close in those meetings, trying to undermine it. And of course, it never got off the ground, but they were trying to create, you know, some kind of subgroup within the Republican Party, basically to revive a Republican way of thinking about foreign policy rather than a neocon vision.
Well, I remember that. I was a college student at that time. And what I do remember specifically is the creation of what was known as the John Randolph Club.
And that was a part of it. I don't think that was the full thing, but I could be
wrong. No, it wasn't, because I don't remember Kirk being there. But they started it in the early 90s, maybe 92, something like that. And I went to one of the first meetings in late 93 as a college kid, just because I thought it would be interesting. It was libertarians like Lou Rockwell and Murray Rothbard and the so-called paleocons, so right. Tom Fleming, the Chronicles Magazine crowd.
Right.
And I liked all those people, and they were all really smart, and I thought they could run rings around their neoconservative opponents, so it seemed like an exciting thing to do. So I went, and that turned out to be a really important event for me because I met a whole lot of people there, but it was really thrilling and exciting. We sang songs around a piano where they had taken traditional songs but then written them with sort of paleo lyrics, like instead of the green berets, it was the blue berets, because you'd have the UN beret, you know. It was tremendous. Or we had a song called "Won't You Come Home, Bill Buckley." So it was, "Won't you come home, Bill Buckley? Won't you come home from the establishment?" It was great. Everybody was singing, having a blast. So those were the days, because the two sides realized we do have differences, but what an opportunity with the Cold War being over to try to revisit this closed question of foreign policy.
Yes, and I think Kirk's fears have been proven right. It's another topic, but empire is out of control.
What I love about this book is that it reminds me of Guido Holzmann's biography of Mises, in that it's not just a bunch of details about then he did this and then his wife did that. You do get biographical information, but it really is an intellectual exploration of this man and of the times he lived in. So you're going to learn an enormous amount of 20th century intellectual history and the history of ideas that we believe in very much, even if a lot of my listeners wouldn't call themselves conservatives. Kirk is interacting with libertarians, and he's wrestling with ideas that are important to us. So you're going to learn an awful lot by reading this book. It's not a dry biography. It's very much alive, I find.
Well, Kirk, of course, was just so quirky that if anybody wrote a biography of him and it wasn't entertaining, they messed up.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah. You already gave us a hint of that, and then I remember reading that he had not. Now, you tell me what the actual details of this are, because I think I remembered it wrong. What was the deal with Kirk and driving a car?
Yeah, well, really quickly, let me say thank you to Tom, because I love Holzmann's biography of Mises. And I don't know if you saw, but I cited it and I used it, relied upon it. I only met Holzmann once, but I was very impressed with him. So thank you for that.
Sure.
That's a high compliment. Kirk used to call me. He is a weird, when it comes to technology, he is really strange. He hated the telephone, hated it, despised it, used to just curse it. He hated automobiles, and he cursed them as well. He did have to drive a Jeep when he was in the military during World War II.
That was the difference. He did learn to drive.
He chose not to. He had to. But as the moment he left the military, he never drove again. And he hated interstates. He believed that the interstates were fascist. He thought that this was nothing. Not only were they made patterned after Hitler's Autobahn, but he also believed that they were meant politically to destroy ethnic neighborhoods and cities. He hated them. So he would never allow anyone to drive on an interstate that he knew. He would never, if he was driving with someone, he would make them take back roads because he just refused to go on the interstate. And he called cars mechanical Jacobins. And he thought that they were meant to destroy America and break up communities. And, you know, growing up in Kansas, Tom, I don't get this because I started driving when I was a farm kid and I got my driver's license. And I don't know if this is still the case in Kansas. I got it at 14. I love driving fast. I love driving, not as much anymore. I love driving recklessly on country roads. I love driving and I love cars. So I don't get this, but he really despised them and would only use them in absolute necessities. But the same was true with TV. Yeah, he would not allow a TV in their home. Yet he had no problem at all with typewriters. He had no problem with word processors, though he was never very good with them. Yet if the technology, as he saw it, allowed for humanity, he was totally fine with that. So his Ludditism was very, very specific and not always consistent.
Well, you know, Brad, on a completely unrelated note, just before we went on, I told you what happened a week ago today when I was recording an episode on a Monday at noon.
With the tornado siren.
They're going now. I don't know if you can hear them, but the tornado sirens in Topeka are going now.
Noon, yeah.
Now, don't anybody panic. There is no tornado. This is only a drill.
Oh, I miss Kansas.
Oh, no, get me out.
Hey, Tom, and can we also say, and I know you've probably already mentioned this, but and I know you're not airing this today, but we are recording this on the 26th anniversary of the coming down of the Berlin Wall, and that means a lot. So
I didn't even know. You're the third person I've interviewed today. So I've been completely lost in interviews. I didn't even know that till you said that.
Well, it's November 9th, right? If you wouldn't have, I mean, there's no reason unless you knew it was November 9th to remember that. But
well, I've shown videos of that to my kids numerous times. I want that seared in their consciousness.
I can't even mention it, Tom, and I'm just sitting here at my computer. I can't mention it without getting – I mean, I just felt my heart stop for a second. So
yeah, what an astonishing thing.
What a blessing that we were alive.
To see that, yeah. And unfortunately, the thing is, a lot of my listeners, Brad, will be too young. They were not actually alive to see that.
That, of course, is not their fault, but it is their fault if they don't remember it.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. We won't blame – we're going to be generous. We won't blame you for not having been born sooner, but –
That's
all right. Listen, Brad, I'm going to, of course, link to Russell Kirk, American Conservative, at tomwoods.com/534, the show notes page for today, and urge people to check it out. And I no doubt it was a labor of love, but it's also hard work to do what you did. And I hope it will be amply rewarded. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom. Great talking as always. God bless.
And that's our episode for today. Join me over in the private Facebook group that the Tom Woods Show Elite has. It's for supporting listeners of the show over at supportinglisteners.com. Once you sign up over there, become part of the Facebook group. We brainstorm about show ideas. We come up with guest suggestions. But more often, we just talk to each other about things that interest us, and we have a good time, and we've got a lot of great people in there. So check that out, supportinglisteners.com. Tomorrow, Mike Church comes back to the show. We're going to talk about what in the world happened. He was the longest running talk show host in the history of satellite radio, and they canned him. So we're going to talk about what happened and what he's up to now. So make sure and check that out. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.